We're looking now at sources of Christian leadership. Sources of Christian leadership. Here's the question. Can pastors and other church leaders learn anything about leadership from President Obama? From President George Bush? From Bill Gates? From General Petraeus? From baseball, basketball coaches? Can pastors and other church leaders learn anything about leadership from purely secular leaders? Well, that's one of the questions I'd like to answer as we look at the three main resources God has given us to teach us about Christian leadership. And the three sources are his precepts, his patterns, and his providence. First of all, God's precepts. Well, God's word is obviously the first source of teaching on Christian leadership. The Bible tells us that there are two fundamentals for a Christian leader: his spiritual life and his moral life. They're not separable, really. But before anyone can become a Christian leader, he must have spiritual life. He must become a Christian. He must be born again. There can be no spiritual leadership without spiritual life. But spiritual life is not enough. There must also be a moral life. Christian leaders lead, as we've said, first and foremost by moral example. And so God's moral law, the Ten Commandments, must shape their moral character. Moreover, a Christian leader has to go beyond having a spiritual life and a moral and a holy life. These are the basics of every Christian's life, aren't they? Every Christian is to have a spiritual and a moral life. So we find in the Bible there are leader-specific precepts and commands in both the Old Testament, as we read in Joshua 1, and in the New, 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, 2 Timothy 2, 24. So that's where we begin: spiritual life, moral life, and a leader-specific ethic, as outlined in the Bible. Secondly, we have God's patterns. In addition to God's commands and instructions, he provides us with models, with metaphors of leadership. And we've mentioned some of them: the servant, the shepherd, the captain, the father, and so on. But God doesn't just give us a description of these leadership models. He makes them come alive in the lives of biblical characters. They're frequently set forth as exemplary leaders with unique leadership qualities. You think of Joseph. What do you think of? You think of long-range planning. Moses. You think of meekness. Jethro. Delegation. David. Team building. Daniel. Courage. The apostles. Pioneering spirit. So on. All these biblical leaders have unique biblical, unique characteristics that are brought alive in their lives as we find them in the Bible. And of course we have the ultimate model, Jesus Christ, who combines every leadership quality in perfect proportion and balance. But God's models are also found in the pages of church history. We can look at the life of Spurgeon, Lloyd-Jones, Dabney, Hodge, William Wilberforce, whatever. There are many Christian leaders in our own day that the Lord has raised up, whose faith we are to follow. Hebrews 13:7. Now, some of them may be internationally known. Some of them may be just our own local pastors, the men, the elders, the ministers that God has brought into our lives that nobody will ever hear of, but are wonderful models of leadership that God has brought into our lives. So, God's precepts first, God's pattern second. The third source is God's providence. In God's gracious providence, he's given leadership gifts to many outside the church. They may be Christians or non-Christians, Christians in non-Christian areas of vocation or non-Christians. They're found in various fields, political, military, sports, business. May we learn anything from such leaders in some of these fields or all of these fields, or not at all? If so, what safeguards do we need to put in place so that we do not contaminate the church with unbiblical practices? Well, of course, there are some Christians who'll say, no, we can't learn anything about leadership from outside the Bible. And I think we can all understand that instinct. We've seen too much, haven't we, of the world's practices and principles corrupting the church. We maybe have seen the churches becoming too much like corporations, pastors becoming too much like CEOs, worship becoming too much like a concert, preaching becoming too much like a stand-up comedy, evangelism becoming too much like a marketing campaign. Yeah, many abuses, many perversions. But despite these perversions and abuses, we shouldn't be stopped from learning from unbelievers in certain areas and with certain safeguards in place. I want to defend that idea a little bit. So what I'm saying is, I want to defend the idea of learning from non-biblical, I didn't say unbiblical, okay? It's a difference. From non-biblical sources. And then look at a couple of safeguards. So, by way of defence, in addition to God's saving grace, the Reformed Church has usually acknowledged God's common grace, whereby he distributes gifts and abilities to non-Christians for the benefit of his church and people. That's my understanding of common grace. John Calvin uses the illustration of spectacles to explain this. He says the Bible is not only what we read, but what we read with. We use its pages as spectacles to view and read the world, and the knowledge, the light of nature, God has distributed throughout it. The Institutes 1:6:1. In the Institutes 2:2:15, he says, the human mind, however much fallen and perverted from its original integrity, is still adorned and invested with admirable gifts from its Creator. We will be careful, says Calvin, not to reject or condemn truth wherever it appears. He goes on in 2:2:15-16. If we regard the Spirit of God as the sole foundation of truth, we shall neither reject the truth itself nor despise it wherever it shall appear, unless we wish to dishonour the Spirit of God. Shall we say that the philosophers were blind in their fine observation and artful description of nature? No. We cannot read the writings of the ancients on these subjects without great admiration. But if the Lord has willed that we be helped in physics, dialectic, mathematics, and other like disciplines by the work and ministry of the ungodly, let us use this assistance. For if we neglect God's gift freely offered in these arts, we ought to suffer just punishment for our sloths. So begin with the doctrine of common grace. Secondly, there are over 20 models of leadership in the Bible. I've listed some of them there. And they've all been brought in or borrowed from the world. They've all been brought in or borrowed from the world. The servant, the shepherd, the captain, the father, the steward. The model was first in the world. By God's providence, of course. And then used by God to teach his church. God did not define servant and shepherd in the Bible initially. The definition, the description, the idea of it was already existing, and he took it in, of course refined it and redirected it, but it was borrowed nonetheless. And third, some of the words used for Christian leaders in the Bible are taken from non-Christian activities. Oikonomia is a noun meaning administration of a household or an office, the management of a state or of a house. And that's the word given to Christian leaders in Luke 16, 1-17, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 2, Titus 1, verse 7, 1 Peter 4, 10. Cybernesis is borrowed from sailing and refers to the helmsman or pilot that guides the vessel to its destination. It's used in Acts 27:11, 1 Corinthians 12:28, Revelation 18:17. Even the word episkopos, usually translated overseer or bishop in the old translations, originally described a man with the responsibility of seeing that things done by others were done right. Titus 1:7. And prostemi in classical Greek referred to leadership in an army, in a state or in a party. There are a range of meanings like guard, be the head of charge over, preside over. We have that in Romans 12:8, 1 Thessalonians 5:12 and other places. So I'm defending this idea of us being able to learn from non-biblical sources, not unbiblical sources, non-biblical sources, because of the doctrine of common grace, because the models God uses in the Bible have already been brought in from outside, and some of the words used for Christian leaders have their definitions from non-Christian activities. But we need safeguards, don't we? If we're going to do this in any way, to any degree, then we've got to put safeguards in place so that we can learn from God's gracious distribution of truth and gifts outside the church without bringing the world into the church. The first safeguard is this: biblical precepts and patterns are non-negotiable. Biblical precepts and patterns are non-negotiable. If any leadership practice or principle out there is found to be contrary to the Bible, it's rejected. It's just a no-brainer. The authority of Scripture stands above everything. Second, biblical precepts and patterns must be studied most. Sometimes when we find out, there's some good stuff over here and there's some good stuff there, the novelty of it can get very attractive, we can get immersed in it, and eventually it becomes the dominant influence in our life. So while we may learn from non-biblical sources, if we're reading, say, the Harvard Business Review and business bestsellers more than the Bible, well, we're in grave danger of drifting from biblical moorings. Thirdly, biblical precepts and patterns should control the big picture. We want to keep the Bible's principles and practices as our overarching control, as our umbrella. We fill in the details, perhaps at times, with some of the details from non-biblical sources. It may be best to give you some examples of what I mean by this. The Bible gives us the general principle of time management. Ephesians 5:16. Redeeming the time because the days are evil. That's a general principle. But it doesn't give us any detail about how to do this. So how do we fill out the details? Well, we can try and figure it out ourselves, or we can look at methods that non-Christians use to manage their time effectively and use time efficiently. We fill in the details of the general biblical principle. Again, the Bible tells us we're to be careful listeners. Be swift to hear. But again, it doesn't really give us too many details about how to get that skill, how to build it, how to grow it, how to strengthen it. We learn the how-to from those who have studied. How to be a skillful and wise listener. The Bible tells us we're to be shepherds. And it does give us some details, but not all the details. We fill out the detail, as almost every commentary and sermon on shepherding does, by studying shepherding in the world. The Bible tells us we're to teach God's word. But it doesn't really tell us how we're to do homiletics, does it? Who ever said that it was good? Where'd you get in the Bible that 3 points are the good way to teach? You don't find that, do you? Intro, outro. Vary your voice. Vary your pace. You don't get that, do you? But that's been found in human experience to be the best ways of communicating. So we have the big picture from the Bible. The details we fill in from outside at times. So with these safeguards in place, I think we can prayerfully plunder the Egyptians for the good of Israel. Let me just go on here before we stop for questions. Let me give you now the secret of Christian leadership. The secret of Christian leadership. Well, the Christian leader's got to juggle innumerable balls while innumerable forces try and pull us in innumerable directions. The Bible itself presents 20 models of leadership. 20! You mean I've got to be 20 things at one time? Well, no, not exactly. Sometimes the situation will call for a single model of leadership. More commonly, depending on the situation, the Christian leader has to combine 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 models in one given situation. And the great secret of Christian leadership is learning to know which models, for which situations, in which proportions. And that's where we so often go wrong. We tend to become imbalanced. So when somebody should be a patient shepherd, he's the courageous captain. When somebody should be the firm father, he's the gentle mother. And you know, they're biblical models, but they're not the biblical model for that situation. What imbalances us? Well, 3 things. First of all, temperament imbalances us. We all have temperaments. We all have different characters. And they're not sinful per se. Just because somebody's more active, energetic, aggressive, more forceful in their leadership doesn't make them more sinful than the more patient, gentle, meek, quiet, listening type. God's given different leaders, different characters for different times and different places, different purposes. But our temperaments, our personalities do tend to imbalance us. So, if there's people in this class who are confident, forceful, they're going to love the authoritative captain model. Men with gentler, more compassionate natures, they're going to default to the caring, nursing mother. Men who enjoy debates, they're going to be the reformer model. Men who hate controversy, going to be much more the peacemaker. Men with speaking skills are going to be great speakers. Men with listening skills are going to be great counsellors, listening. So we all have that tendency to default, to bias to our own temperament. We need to get to know who we are, what we are, where we're likely to bias to, default to, and try and take corrective measures. We've got to work on our weaknesses, in other words, as well as beware of our strengths, because they can so often become our weaknesses. So temperament imbalances us. Sin imbalances us. Sin has weakened every part of us, all our faculties. It's affected every one of our gifts and abilities. You just think of our thinking abilities. Every aspect of leadership involves our brain. Every thought that we have passes through our brain. Everything you're perceiving just now is passing through your brain. Every word you're hearing, every movement I make here, every cough, it's all passing through your brain. Every thought we have, every perception, everything we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, passes through our brain with this phenomenally complex system of switches and chemicals. Well, that most complex of organs is fallen. It's cursed, just like our fingers are, just like our eyes are, just like our ears are. We've been weakened in that most central of our faculties, that most critical and crucial of members. I read recently this brain surgeon, Ludwig Zrinzo, said this: the brain is the final frontier. It used to be the ocean and space, now they're talking about the inside being the final frontier. If you look at the number of neurons, synapses and connections, these vastly outnumber the stars in our galaxy. That's one brain. One brain outnumber the stars in our galaxy in terms of the number of neurons, synapses, connections. And we won't understand all the complexities for many generations to come. Stanford recently issued research that showed a single human brain has more switches than all the computers and routers and internet connections on Earth. Hey, that's me. Unfortunately, it's fallen. Like the rest of our bodies, they're faulty. Our minds are faulty. And that means that even if we lived in a perfect world, everything out there was perfect, our perception of it, our understanding of it, our comprehension of it is going to be imperfect. And even if we had perfect hearts, with perfect desires, perfect motives, these pass through and reach expression through our brains. And so they're going to be obstructed and misdirected. They're going to be frustrated and weakened by passing through this fallen organ. So whether it's an incoming perception or an outgoing thought, they're all going to be damaged in one way or another by passing through our brain. We don't live in a perfect world either. We don't have perfect hearts either. We have imperfect minds, brains in an imperfect world with imperfect hearts. Well, what a toxic mix. We've got sin coming at us from every direction, affecting, contaminating everything within and without, all being processed by this sin-cursed brain. All these negative forces. Well, and we're going to walk the leadership tightrope? Sin imbalances us. Thirdly, role models imbalance us. Well, we're all thankful, aren't we, for the powerful impact of godly men and women in our lives. I'm sure we can all look back and think of pastors, elders, teachers who modelled godly leadership for us. And we can't help but consciously or unconsciously imitate them. However, strangely, oddly, we tend to imitate their quirks, rather than their strengths. Don't you've ever noticed that? When people imitate another preacher, they usually imitate the thing that really bugs everybody else. The eccentricity, the idiosyncrasy, rather than the strength and the qualities. And even if that model was just, you know, perfect, it was perfect for that situation and that time. We're going to be in different situations and different times. That kind of leadership may not fit our time, our situation. So the secret of Christian leadership is to know the balance of leadership characteristics required for every situation we're in. Knowing our temperament, knowing our sin, knowing how role models have influenced us for good and for ill will help us to prayerfully seek God's wisdom to know the kind of leader we should be in each situation. So that, what does that mean? That means that the Christian leader is like a chameleon, in the best sense of the word. Chameleon? Chameleon? You know what I mean? He's changing all the time, depending on the situation he's in. And they're not changing fundamentally in his core and his morals and his ethics, but changing his approach. In one day, you'll have to be a courageous captain, then a far-sighted visionary, then a team builder, then a peacemaker, then a counsellor, then an administrator, then a judge, all in one day. And our ability to choose the right model for the right situation or in the right proportions will make or break our ministries and our congregations. It's that significant. If what's called for is a listening ear and all we do is talk, if we choose peacemaking instead of holy warfare when facing false doctrine, then we're going to fail. We fail ourselves, we fail our congregations, and we fail God. The secret of leadership is that balance. And in the light of that, we're not so thankful for that promise. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraids not, and it shall be given him. This should be our daily prayer and experience of this wonderful promise. God alone is able to balance out our imbalances and keep us on the tightrope. But I want to conclude with the satisfaction of leadership. We've looked at quite a number of the difficulties and challenges, obstacles. We'll continue to look at some of these as we look at the models individually, but I don't want to end this on a really depressing note. There's going to be loneliness and fatigue and criticism and rejection and stress, yes, but leadership of Christ's church is incredibly satisfying as well, rewarding. There's personal satisfaction, first of all. Yeah, we have challenges, we have disappointments, we have failures. But we also get to see God's people grow and develop and mature under our leadership. We get to counsel them and advise them and help them through problems, see them defeat problems and answer problems. And we see decisions we've made vindicated. We see team spirit develop. We see divided people united. We see dormant gifts being deployed for the benefit of the church. It is so wonderfully rewarding to be used of God in these ways. There's so much personal satisfaction. There's also congregational appreciation. We don't serve God's people to be praised by them, but it's very rewarding when fellow Christians express gratitude for our guidance or leadership. when we sense a growing love of God's people towards us and their respect for us, our wisdom, our maturity, our gifts, our counsel. It's just so encouraging, especially when you hear maybe in prayer, you sense in the prayers of God's people a growing thankfulness for their pastor. You get it also in visitation. In my last congregation, there was a fair number of village and country folks, although it was in a town with lots of people that came in from surrounding villages. When I came back from pastoral visitation, I often come home with bagfuls of eggs and pork chops and chickens and lamb and salmon. And I tell you, no food tasted as good as that food, because you tasted the love of God's people in it. You tasted their appreciation. And when food is marinated in Christian love, it is tasty. And I think that congregational appreciation will go on into eternity. Part of our reward in heaven will be to see the impact of our lives and our leadership on those we led in this world that maybe we didn't see the fruit of here. But we'll see there, in so many dimensions and angles, how what we did and said or didn't do and didn't say have borne fruit in precious lives. And really, I think that'll be a wonderful experience. And that brings us on to our eternal reward. We don't want to be the leaders because of rewards in this life or the next, but God does encourage us with wonderful promises of eternal reward. Matthew 25, 23. You think also of Daniel chapter 12, verse 3. This wonderful promise. They that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. So there's great satisfaction now and forever in Christian leadership, despite all the difficulties and trauma that we will sometimes have to pass through in this world.